what I kind of meant to ask was, a lot of these short wildcat type strikes, like the sit down strike that you led, did these contribute to the general strike that occurred in 1946 or 7 in Oakland?
Well, the general strike was part of the 46 strike wave. You can't extract one from the other. There was a great deal of damned up militancy. People who had worked throughout the war had been taking all this crap from employers in the name of the war effort. And that kind of phony patriotism instead of real patriotism. And it was time to catch up after the war, so that there were wildcat strikes going on apace. As a matter of fact, there are more people out on strike in 1946 in the 46 strike wave than any time before or since. It's the largest strike wave ever occurred in the United States. That occurred as the last gasp of a labor force that was coming back, of a labor force that was still in place. That is, the GIs were not all back yet, and the people who had spent the last 4 years together were still pretty much together, or they hadn't been swamped by new workers coming in or guys returning from the armed forces. A lot of new technology and not mechanization hadn't yet been introduced. The Oakland General Strike was, I think, in December. Mary got my Jeep and drove down with some of her girlfriends from campus to travel around the streets and look at it. We in the CIO were not a part of it officially. That is, the state of California CIO was run by pro-C peers. And they were for having the general strike after the war for 9 years. I mean, having a no-strike pledge almost permanent, at least for 9 years after the war. When the general strike broke out, the three ships at the Oakland Army base, the gangs all walked off them and went out in the streets and were on strike. Bridges immediately sent politicals, gangs of politicals, back to those ships and kept working them. In order to participate in that general strike, we had to stay out of work, absenteeism.
Well, maritime workers were a big part of the strike, weren't they?
Well, they were, partly because I phoned them. That is, I was still a member of the Sailors Union. I'm downtown Oakland. I didn't get the streetcar. I got off the streetcar. The strike had started, and there was no bus to take me to the rest of the way to East Oakland to my job. And I didn't see any official leadership. There was not an official leader anywhere to be found. They're all hiding. This is strictly a rank and file, downtown alone, and on strike alone. So I, and it might not have been the best thing to do, phoned up the Sailors Union, got Lundberg, and said, hey, there's a strike over here and there's no organization. And we need a way of developing a network. And whatever you can do. What he did was he sent about 30 Hawaiians with a bunch of SIUSUP Brotherhood of the Sea buttons and began distributing those as some kind of strike police badge. At the Oakland General Strike meeting downtown in the Oakland Auditorium, Lundberg was the only one to know what to say to the, and it was all demagogy. Oakland City Council had tried to break the strike and brought on the general strike had taken lessons from Hitler and Stalin, and they were finks. And he was the only one who talked radical like that, because he knew from the past, the recent past, although he had already sold out. And I had yet absorbed that sellout, and that's why I would call the union and get him and tell him to get some forces over there.
Did the strike die because of lack of strong leadership?
Yes. The retail clerk's leadership and the Teamster leadership was very different. That is, finally, the retail clerk's leadership did show up, but they had all this strength. Remember, the general strike was called in support of the workers at Kahn's and Hastings department store. And here they had the town shut down, and that leadership did not come up with an agreement that would protect the jobs of those people and settle their grievances. They went back to work with no protection and with no gains.
But a lot of other workers were so ready to strike that they walked out in support of the retail clerk.
Absolutely. It gave that accidental strike, so-called accidental strike, without any leadership, no one calling it, turned out to be an opportunity for people to vent their feelings about what had happened to them on the job during the war. The leaders, the real leaders of that strike, were the Key System bus drivers who were just back from after the war. They still were wearing the Eisenhower jackets, but now they had converted them to bus driver jackets. A lot of them still had their gold hash marks, overseas marks, on their jackets. I remember, I've told this a number of times, an Army recruiting truck came down the street during the general strike, and some young lieutenant in the back of the truck says in the microphone over the PA, loud PA system, "You ought to be ashamed of yourself striking, you ought to be out fighting for your country." It was so recently after the war, maybe he thought he could get away with that. Some big guy said, "Where do you think we got these?" and pointed to his overseas marks. And he said, "Fall in," and about 50 to 75 guys fell in close order, and he started a close order drill, and more guys, and more guys. Pretty soon he had a company, not a platoon, but a company. And pretty soon he had more than a company. I mean, he had hundreds in close order drill. What are you going to do with them now? Marched on City Hall, demanded to see them, the head of the city council. No one would come out to talk to him, but he went to the seat of power in the city, the ones who had called on scab trucks from L.A. to come and be herded into those stores by Oakland police.
This is Pat McCauley. It is now December 5th. I am in Stan Weir's office of Single Jack Books, overlooking the harbor in Los Angeles. And
Stan, when we last talked, we were talking about the general strike in Oakland. Is there anything else about that general strike that comes to your mind?
That general strike confirmed for me ideas that I had been having for some time. It seemed to me that wherever I look, the membership of unions and of political parties I belong to, a political grouping I belong to, the membership was ahead of the leadership. But I'm going to talk about unions now. It seemed to me that not only were the members of the unions I had been in and was in ahead of the officialdom on how to fight the employer and willingness to fight the employer, way ahead. But they were way ahead when it came to the invention of democratic methods for furthering that fight. And those methods developed a societal set of attitudes on the part of these people. The officialdom you mentioned when I said that you couldn't find a union official downtown Oakland, and you asked me before we started here today, do you think that shocked the officials? Well, it had to have shocked them half out of their senses. We were, at that time, it was close after the war. I, for example, had at Cedar and San Pablo got a bus to Ashby, got a trolley in downtown Oakland, then got a bus to East Oakland where I was working in the East Oakland Chevrolet plant. When we got to downtown Oakland that morning, around 6, between 6 and 6:30 in there, a man came running over to our streetcar and talked briefly, just briefly, and fast and hard to our conductor and motorman in the streetcar, and they got off and began to walk away. And we yelled at him, "Hey, what's this?" And he explained that Los Angeles scab-driven trucks with merchandise for the two department stores that were on strike, Conn's and Hastings department store, that these trucks were being herded through the city right now by the Oakland police. And that's wrong. And they disappeared. So we were all there downtown, and we couldn't get to work. And immediately a carnival kind of attitude hit us.
Did they leave the trolley just...
right there. And the trucks that the men were driving, they just left them right at that spot. They didn't even pull them to the curb. And, of course, they did it with a method that had its own method. It's another way of protesting. Well, the first thing that hit us in this whole thing was, we got a good excuse. We can't get to work. And we're here, so it was kind of a carnival. It wasn't a half an hour before we were going into bars and saying, no hard liquor. Serve beer and wine if you must, but mainly beer. And you can stay open only if you bring your jukebox out in front and turn it on loud. And we were dancing 7 o'clock in the morning, men and women, and joking and so on. Feeling like, you know, God, freedom. It was marvelous. When you're a factory hand, if you get to sit down 3 minutes in a day more than your lunchtime, you figure like it's a great day. You beat them out of 3 minutes, you know.
Yeah.
I used to, when the line would break down, it would be like I would go into laughter almost immediately and stay there. I'd laugh at anybody's joke and so would everybody else. If the line, assembly line broke down at Chevrolet.
The CIO wasn't supporting this general strike. Did workers stay out? Or?
No. Well, those who couldn't get to work didn't go to work. Yeah. But the CIO was led by the Communist Party at the time, and Communist Party supporters. And I think I've said that here in this tape. I was meeting at the state CIO convention that year that got up and challenged, I've forgotten his name, Dick, the chair of the convention. He said, he was from Local 6 Warehouse, ILWU. And his dad owned a warehouse. That's how he struck against his father. And that's how he got started in unionism. I've forgotten his last name. But I said, where was the CIO in the Oakland General Strike? We had to stay away from work in order to participate. What is this? Where's solidarity? And Paul Schlipp, the Secretary Treasurer of the state CIO, got up and said it wasn't a general strike. We weren't in it. Well, that kind of double think, that using Orwell's term, it was a transplantation of that kind of thinking into the situation in Oakland. But here we were, and without any leadership, and within, by noon that day, the carnival was kind of over. That is, I think we can't go on like this forever. They'll come and get us. Somebody will come and get us, you know, and it won't be good. So I had made a phone call and to the Sailors Union to see what kind of help I could get
from seamen who are ashore and not working. And I talked to Lundberg. And Lundberg spoke that night, I believe it was, or the next night at the Oakland Auditorium in the general strike meeting. And he demagogically was militant, and he gave people what they wanted to hear. He denounced the city fathers and the police as people who had been reading the writings of Stalin and Hitler. And he knew that it's time to get mad. He wasn't afraid, like the rest of the officials. They're afraid to get up there and even sound off. But without any leadership, we cordoned the town off. You could get out without a union card. You couldn't get in without a union card. There was a guy going down the street, a big, great big guy with a typewriter. And people said, hey, where are you going with a typewriter? And he began to run. They ran and they arrested him, in effect, until he explained that he wasn't stealing the typewriter, that he didn't believe in the strike, and he was taking his home, his work home, because he might not be able to get to work the next day. And they said, go, get in your car and go.
Was it the residents in these blocks that
no, this is downtown.
I meant residents of the offices that formed these informal authority sort of groups.
No, it was the people who got off the buses and the streetcars. It was the truck drivers. It was the people in their cars going to work. It wasn't the residents so much, although West Oakland, which is close by, the blacks involved in this strike, some of them had just walked up from there where they lived. But the peoples in the offices, many were non-union. Now, the OPEIU, the office workers and union, and the retail clerks did participate in this strike because it was for Kahn's and Hastings department store workers. All right? But there was no, that I know of, there was no general outpour of office workers just boom like that who are non-union and suddenly got the word. We did have experiences like this. Non-union people would come out and they'd be going to go home and they didn't know for how long. And they were impressed at the order and the neatness. That is, we kept the streets clean. There was no littering. Like I say, there were people who had cordoned, we had cordoned the city off, all streets leading out of downtown Oakland. We had the downtown 10 square blocks. Maybe it was more than that. Maybe it was more like 20. But there was a desire to really do the right thing by everybody who was on your side. There was no rousting anybody or anybody stealing gas from other people's cars or breaking in. That, so far as we could tell, those 54 hours were crimeless downtown. Like in Albert Rise Williams' book, Through the Russian Revolution. He was a journalist. And he went to Russia because of the Russian Revolution in February. And he came back and wrote a book about what he saw. He's a good journalist. He's walking up and down the streets of Leningrad. And he sees people walking by shoe stores, for example, with broken panes. And no one is reaching inside and grabbing those shoes and running away from them. Already there was a sense of collective property. That's not ours, just a steal. We will take care of that. We will divvy that up, so to speak. And then, of course, I had read about Antonov Ovsyenko in that book, same book. There was open warfare between the whites and the reds. The whites had captured the telephone building in, I had forgotten whether it was Moscow or St. Petersburg, Leningrad. And the whites had captured Antonov Ovsyenko, the head of the workers' red militia. And he's imprisoned in the telephone building. And people are shooting at one another and killing one another in this situation. And the Reds are ringing the court all the way around the building. The whites send out a Red Cross truck that they had captured, ostensibly with wounded. The Reds let the truck go through the line, the Red Cross truck, and get out around the corner, out of sight of the whites, and they grabbed the truck. And there were no wounded in it. And people inside confessed immediately that they were going for munitions. The Reds turned into a Trojan horse. They stuck highly armed people into that Red Cross truck, and they went back in through a half an hour later, and zap! And that was the end of that. The whites immediately surrendered. Where's Antonov Povsienko? Or this is your neck unless you produce him. They release him, and Antonov Povsienko is just standing there, and the rest of the Reds move to kill or harm bodily all the whites standing there who had imprisoned him. And he grabbed a gun away from someone and said, the first one who puts a hand on any of these whites that we've been fighting right now, I will shoot him. And they said, what, you'd shoot us? We're on your side. He says, I know. But you will damn the revolution by doing wrong. These people deserve a trial, like prisoners of war. And you don't represent the new if you just... Because you said they do it to us. Of course they do it to us, but we don't do it to them. We represent the new society. And he had been on the streets the whole time as head of the worker militia. Albert Rice Williams says the people caught on immediately that simply Osenko was the first to become objective in this situation. And then the Reds led the whites through the town from the telephone building to the jail. And many of them were attacked and beat up by townspeople who were saying, you got whites? Let's get them now. Let's do them in. And the Reds, the same Reds who had wanted to do them in half an hour earlier, said, no, we're taking them. We're going to try them. And, of course, a lot of whites got out of jail real quick just by promising. The Reds were very lenient in that time. But there was this morality, the feeling that ends and means have to always stick together. And this is the working class itself at the very bottom insisting upon that, without any kind of long rationalizations about, well, this is a special situation and all that malarkey. It's hung to it and stayed with it until the revolution itself had been starved out.
So in Oakland...
And you could see that in Oakland. You could see the potential for that. Mm-hmm. Right there in the
spontaneous
street.
Morality.
Yes.
Do you think that the fact that people had just gone through the World War II experience, did that contribute to in any way to this, this natural, not only spontaneous morality, but incredible order that took place?
I don't know. There's no way of knowing the answer to that. I can only tell you what my feel was. I think that there were people there who hadn't really thought about a number of these things that the general strike posed for them in their minds. And they approached the problem in their minds and they came up with these kinds of answers. Because the kind of lives they lead, doesn't lead them to start bemoaning upon the terrible people the workers are, they're lazy, they're this or that or the other thing, or they don't pay their rent on time and all that. The people have nothing to gain by that. These people came up with brilliant ideas, and some of them had thought it through beforehand in all probability, and some of them... Trotsky speaks of this in the history of the Russian Revolution. That suddenly people's minds are liberated, and it staggers them. Suddenly they're free, and some of those who had been the most servile the day before October or February became the most bold. Zap! I don't know the no one knows the exact process of thinking of a crowd in that way, but...
Well, you saw this happen in Oakland.
Crowds, rather than being, in my experience, crowds of this kind, rather than being surly lynch mob types that are very close to that, just on the other side of the fence. No. My experience is that these, it's in the crowd that there's the most genius. At Chevrolet plant, when we had the sit-down strike, the same thing occurred. That is, I stopped people from walking out. And I said, when we all gathered together again on the loading dock of the East Oakland plant, I said, if any of us will clock out, I didn't finish my sentence, someone said, a lot of us will never get back in. And someone else said, but if we hang tough here, available for work, the moment they begin to live up the contract and the grievance we've just won, then we'll see. That no one even said will survive. I mean, the sentence was never totally finished. Everybody understood immediately. And that's what we did. We stayed right there, visible and available to work the moment that they quit reneging on the supply of gloves, which we wore out 3 pair a week. It's that same, the brilliance of people who have been released from the necessity to hide their feelings. Who knows what anybody really believes when they're working on the job for an employer? They're going to, you ask them a million questions, they're always going to answer the same way. That is, whatever strengthens their position on the job. They're not going to weaken that. If, that is, if you're an interviewer from somewhere. If you're a, if you come as a psychologist or an academic and you come interviewing people in the job, even if you, Harry Bridges sent me down here to the waterfront, fellows, and he said it was okay that I talked to you, fellows. You think they're going to tell them, this guy, really, the score? Never.
Yeah. Well, Stan, I'll get back to the your party. WP asked you to get inside of, you know, to get in, into the auto in order to support the Luther caucus. What was so important about the Luther caucus, and who did they oppose?
Well, the this fight shaped up with Luther, the Luther caucus, opposed to the R.J. Thomas and George Addis caucus. That was a coalition caucus, coalition between the Philip Murrayites, the middle-of-the-road conservative CIO top leadership, which R.J. Thomas followed, and the supporters of the Communist Party point of view, their labor beliefs. They had had the leadership of the union all the way through the war, and they had misled it terribly all the way through the war, giving up conditions that were hard won in the strikes of 30s. They were for going back to peace work. They were for national labor conscription. They were for a no-strike pledge during and after the war, and so on. Luther, at least in the beginning, opposed them from the left. Now, Luther had taken over the rank-and-file caucus, which was built primarily by left-wing politicals during the war, and that means mainly by Trotskyists, except it did not include the orthodox and largest group of the Trotskyists, the Socialist Workers' Party people. They were in the R.J. Thomas and George Addis caucus 90% of the time. I think there was one brief interlude where they jumped over to Luther for a moment, or got at least differed with the Addis Thomas people. People who were opposed to the CP from the left as rank and filers or as politicals made the rank and file caucus. Luther wouldn't touch it because he meant job action during the war, and he didn't want that connected with his own history, his own reputation. But the minute the war was over, or in Europe, he began making innuendo and then directly, and took, and he did take over the leadership of the rank and file caucus and became the Luther caucus. Now he needed these lefties and these militants, and they made him president of the union. They didn't give him a majority in the executive board. At the next convention, he got a majority on the executive board. Who did he need to get all that crowd? He needed the Catholics, for example, the ACTU, Association of Catholic Trade Unions. And they were the ones who were really red-baiting the hell out of the other side. And you can begin to see Luther moving over into a red-baiting position in order to get a clean